Welcome to the Sunbury Press Book Show on the BookSpeak Network. Sunbury Press publishes print, electronic, and audiobooks under a variety of imprints and categories, available worldwide wherever books are sold. And now your host, the founder and CEO of Sunbury Press, Lawrence Knorr. Good day. I'm Tori Gates, the producer of this podcast and also the host of the BookSpeak Network's Brown Posey Press Show. Recently, Sunbury Press founder Lawrence Knorr and several authors gathered at St. Francis University in Loretto, Pennsylvania, for the annual Writers' Conference of Northern Appalachia, also known as WACONA. There were a number of forums, talks, and discussions about this part of the U.S., which has a long and fascinating history when it comes to the arts. WACONA's focus is on the authors, and I was able to speak with a few of them about their work and what makes this area unique. First, we hear from P.J. Picciarillo, a founder of the conference and author of books that include The Indigo Scarf.
This is the fourth conference we've had live. We had one conference virtual during COVID. Each year we've grown. We've been hosted at various locations in Wheeling for our first in the downtown area. Since then, we've been at three different universities that have invited us in to have the conference. We're up to about 110 people this year, and that was full capacity. We had to start turning people away.
And that is something that's a growth is something that you really want. And I noticed here from my notes that you had started doing a conference, it says here, in Brookville back in 2018. And you had what am I looking at here?
So in 2018, we had our formation meeting. We formulated the idea, the concept. And from that point, at that meeting, we developed the mission statement. We came up with our name, identified the region. You know, what is Northern Appalachia or Appalachia, however you want to say it. And we identified that as the Appalachian or Appalachian counties of Pennsylvania, New York, Maryland, Ohio, and the northern half of West Virginia.
Mm-hmm. And I've asked this question to others. What makes this area so unique? Because this is an area that seems like a crossroads of a number of different cultures and a number of different peoples, and there seems to be a lot more there, too.
So the answer to that is yes. That is a big part of it. You described it. It's not as easy to put your finger on this area, and that's what makes it distinct. And that's what makes it distinct from southern Appalachia. You know, we're considered Appalachian, but most everybody you meet around here says, I didn't even know I lived in Appalachia. And what we've discovered is that we share things in common with southern Appalachia, but we also have the additional industrial heritage and a much broader ethnic diversity in northern Appalachia. So we have some cities, but mostly smaller industrial towns. And like I said, the broad diversity and our geology and our landscapes are different as well.
Mm-hmm. And you have written from this area as well. And the conference is really drawing people from a lot of different areas. I just, from just walking about the tables, I am seeing so many different it's like genres and subgenres, fiction, nonfiction, that sort of thing. Where do you think the real focus is?
I think the core is the history, because we're so steeped in our traditions that a lot of writing comes from that place. And that's the canon that we're more recognizing than nurturing right now. We're looking back at the people who have chronicled this region, and we're collecting that in the canon, because that's never been done, because it's never been thought of as a body. But now we're also learning the people, the writers who have moved on to new genres and are writing about our region in different ways, from poetry to memoir, and in the less traditional fictional narrative, which is still there, we're bringing that in, and that's more the contemporary work and the new genres that we're recognizing as speaking from this region. We also look at outdoor writing, because it's rich in that, and that includes writing on conservation and recreation and right down to hunting and fishing. There's a strong tradition in those areas, too, that distinguishes us. So, yeah, and you see some of all that here now.
And there's a real, like, record that's being kept. And the other thing, too, is the growth of the writer, the growth of the artist. It's like they're moving into something. That new thing still maintains, like, elements of the original kind of thing. And it's pretty exciting growth, isn't it?
It is. And I'm glad you said that, because our focus for this conference, which is really only one thing we do among others, is craft. We want to give our writers a place to expand their horizons, to network and meet people, and also to enhance their own craft, to better their own writing. And so that's why you'll see people invited in here that aren't necessarily Appalachian writers, but that have some aspect of craft that they want to share. And so that's why we bring them in to promote our kind of writing.
Mm-hmm. What is the future for the conference and for this kind of craft in general? Where do you see it down the road?
I see the conference continuing because we are really the premier conference in the region. We're the conference that's dedicated to this genre that we've really only begun to recognize. But I think we have to branch off, and we're already starting to have smaller mini conferences so that we can reach the various regions within the region, the various various pockets of the region, and reaching those people. We have a literary journal. We're also working on developing that canon and trying to find a partner to curate it with us so that we can have it recognized. We have a partnership with Catamount as a publisher it's an imprint with Sunbury Press that is dedicated to this work, and that's something we never had before, and it's really beginning to distinguish us and create more and more of this literature.
All right. And how about a little about you? Because a while back, I had you on my podcast for the Indigo Scarf, which was quite a work. And how about you? What's happening with your writing?
Oh, I have three published books. I have Heartwood, The Indigo Scarf, which was really my biggest labor of love. That was, as we talked in the interview, a lot of research went into that. It celebrated the history of two escaped slaves in north central Pennsylvania during pioneer times. Mm-hmm. And then I have a collection called Nunc Stans that has a novella and stories in it. I'm working on a novel right now. Everything I write is historical, but this is historical into the 1980s and 1990s. So my writing is a very slow process, so a novel takes me a few years for sure. So that's my writing, and then I do a lot of advocacy work with the conference. I also edit the journal, and also in the books that they're beginning to bring back from the past that had gone out of print.
All right. And for those within the region or out who want to find out more, where can they find out about this?
So our acronym is WCONA, WCONA.com is where you find our website. You'll find our mission. You'll see our map. You'll be able to get on our mailing list if you'd like. The Northern Appalachia Review is the name of the journal to go ahead and submit to, and that is NorthernAppReview.com.
Coming up, we'll hear from author and essayist Ben Moyer when the Sunbury Press Book Show continues.
Sunbury Press Books brings you the history of Pennsylvania. Check out Lancaster's Golden Century, 1821 to 1921 by H.M.J. Kline, Donald Kent's The French Invasion of Western Pennsylvania, or the Keystone Tombstone series written by Joe Farrell and Joe Farley. Click on the Books tab at sunburypress.com and find works of history, fiction, and nonfiction from the Keystone State.
Welcome back. Outdoor writer and essayist Ben Moyer joins us next. His work has appeared regularly in the Northern Appalachia Review and Pittsburgh Quarterly Magazine, among other publications. Just released on Catamount Press, a collection of his essays, Smoke to See By. He discusses his thoughts on the WCONA conference.
I always enjoy coming to this meeting. I enjoy it for a number of reasons. For one thing, it calls attention to It shines a light, if you will, on what I consider my home region. I'm from southwestern Pennsylvania, and I feel deeply rooted in the place and the culture here. And this is a group of people that try to express that in one way or another, through poetry, through fiction, nonfiction, their experiences, their observations, interviews with people they've known from the region. So I enjoy it because it's an opportunity to share that interest and hone my craft also of writing.
Okay. So I have spoken with P.J. Piccirillo about this, and there is something that makes every section of our planet unique. What do you think makes what we call Northern Appalachia stand out?
That's really interesting, Tori. I think that it's a combination of things. If we're getting really specific about this region, I think that Number one, in an ecological sense, it's very interesting because it's in some ways, this is cliche, but it's a crossroads in many ways of species from the north, south, east, and west that converge in this region. It's also interesting to me because many species of living things, plants and animals, that kind of have their home base far to the north of here in Canada, the Great Lakes, their ranges extend southward down along the mountains, which is very interesting to me because of the cooler climate that you find at a higher elevation.
Right.
There are many, many examples of that. So ecologically, the region's interesting, but it's also interesting because of culture. And we have so many more cultural influences here than you would see even in other parts of the Appalachian Mountains. And because we had a greater influence from parts of Europe, I think they came in here to work in coal mines and steel mills. It was more diverse here for one reason or another, ethnically and culturally. So when you mix all that together, it's a unique region.
And that's such a unique ground for your growing up and that sort of thing. I've always believed that what we experience, what we read, what we listen to from our early life onward is an influence. It may not be what we stay with, but it's sort of like a jumping off point. Tell us a little bit about Southwest PA growing up. What was influencing you?
Yes, I can do that. I grew up in a rural area and a coal mining area. My grandfather was a coal miner. On my dad's side, my grandfather on my mother's side worked on the coke ovens, which maybe a lot of people aren't familiar with that, but the coke ovens were these long batteries of ovens that were built next to the coal mines, and they baked coal inside them,
right,
as a pure form of carbon, which was a fuel for the steel industry in Pittsburgh. So on one side of my family, they dug the coal, and on the other side, they made coke out of it. So I feel rooted because of that.
Mm-hmm.
But then when I was a child, my dad and my uncles took me hunting and fishing. And it really stuck with me. I really bought into it. I loved it. But it always seemed to me to be something more than just a pastime or a diversion.
Mm-hmm.
To go hunting or fishing to me seemed like a pathway or an avenue through which you could access something fundamental and meaningful and profound,
right,
which was nature, the natural world. And to me, to hunt and fish was a humbling experience to be able to possess this beautiful wild thing in your hand.
Right.
It wasn't something to be taken lightly, and it had a deep influence on me in an emotional way. And I think somehow that grew into my desire to convey these thoughts and feelings to other people through the written word.
And what kind of authors did you read that maybe are your influences or helped lead you toward this?
Yeah, I started out reading writers who were pretty local to this, or at least from this state.
Okay.
Writers that like Ned Smith, who wrote in Pennsylvania Game News. That's the magazine of the Pennsylvania Game Commission.
Right.
It's about hunting and wildlife in Pennsylvania. And he wrote a column for many years called Gone for the Day. And he went out into the woods and onto the streams, and he was a very observant person. He was an artist, too. He was a fine artist, mm-hmm. Ned Smith. And a painter, an illustrator.
Right.
But he also was a wonderful writer, and he wrote about the things that he observed and experienced. And then later, I got to know writers like Aldo Leopold and Sand County Almanac, Henry David Thoreau, of course, Ed Abbey,
mm-hmm.
who's from Western Pennsylvania.
Right. And so it goes from there. Now, tell us about this new work of yours, Smoke to See By. That's a great title.
Well, the title came from This is a collection of essays, reflective essays about personal relationship with nature in this region. And one of the essays came to me, or the idea for the germ of the essay came to me when I was looking into a campfire, right, watching the smoke rise.
Okay.
And that seemed to give me an idea. And so that's where the title for that piece came from. And then I liked that for the title of the whole book. But it's a collection of works that that I've written about this region. And I broke it up into different sections called In Our Place, Highland Marvels, which is a little more tightly focused about certain things, brook trout, rattlesnakes, blackberries.
That's cool.
Ash trees, oak trees. Then there is one chapter or one group of essays that's about trout fishing.
Okay.
Because that's one of the things that really connect me to place. And by my granddaughter, who was 6 years old at the time. She'll be eight tomorrow.
Right.
But she and I made tea together out of bee balm.
Oh, wow.
I don't know if you know the flower. It's a showy red native wildflower. It's a member of the mint family. And she always loved those flowers when she would come to the house. Fortunately, we see her often. And every July when they would bloom, she would run out and point them out to me. And so I wanted her to remember them even more vividly. And so we made tea out of it.
Oh, that's awesome.
And that's, I wrote about that, and that's one of the sections.
Let me ask you this about the essay. When I think of essayists, I think of people like James Baldwin, who can just write a short piece, and it is so packed. And there's so many others. I just thought of him off the top of my head. But the art of the essay, that is one in itself. Is there a difference, say, from a short story, a poem, or how does it feel for you? It seems to be the thing that works.
That's all I can say, is that it seems to be the thing that works. I have tried to write poetry. I wrote one poem once about a mayfly, and I even remember it. I guess I've tried to write fiction. Maybe I haven't tried hard enough, because it's not something that comes to me naturally. But the nonfiction essay, as you said, it seems to be what works for me. And it's a matter of curiosity and observation and being open to things and learning to be open to things. There is a skill to that.
Yes.
That you can hone. And then I more or less cook it in my mind for a while.
That's the thing about the writing style. I do the same thing. An idea has to cook for a while before I'm ready to do anything with it.
Right. And then I'll try to think of a way to open it.
Right.
That makes sense to me. And then I have this thing that I've developed called mind pictures.
Okay.
Where I this goes back to the observational stage, but I can look at something and almost take a picture of it with my mind and then go back to it and recall it for the description or the interpretation of it in the essay. But you have to pay attention at the time.
Right.
And I don't know. And there's a period where, and you'll understand this, is a period where you're writing and you can just kind of open your mind and think about that picture. And things and ways to say something will come to you. That's all I know how to say.
And that's a way to apply this. This is how we apply to our writing, no matter what it is. It's like to be able to open up that thing. What you have from what you've described, and I think about growing up in northern New England and that kind of thing, it's like you have an intimacy with the real thing. You have an intimacy with it, and you're able to like translate that out. That's pretty cool.
Intimacy is the word. That's the word. Thank you for. That's important. That's what I seek. And I believe that things like hunting and fishing, which sometimes are frowned upon,
right,
in some sectors, particularly hunting. And I understand that. I do. Yeah. I understand that. I understand that because of the way some hunters behave and the messages that they send, which are boorish and coarse. But they are an avenue to intimacy with nature, and if done with humility and respect.
And my father certainly did that with all of us. I think he taught us quite a lot more by example than by anything he ever said to understand the moment that we have here right this minute. It's a very Buddhist thing. He wouldn't believe that, but it it is. It's like, take this moment and don't forget this because, you know, who knows what will happen next. But that's kind of cool.
Right, right.
Well, this is fantastic. I've been really happy to hear this from you. Your style and your focus is a very unique one, but at the same time, it applies to writing. Now, tell me about some of your other work. What's next for you?
Well, I work all the time. I have a number of periodicals that I do regular work for. Okay. I occupy the same space page-wise that Ned Smith did years ago when I was a child reading him. I write a monthly column in Pennsylvania Game News called The Wild Around. And I really enjoy writing that. It's about 1,400 words every month, and it's about some subject in nature within Pennsylvania. And it you know, a large part of the audience of Pennsylvania Game News are hunters.
Right.
But that's not the only responsibility of the Pennsylvania Game Commission. Mm-hmm. Their responsibility is for all wildlife. So sometimes the columns will deal with hunting species, and sometimes they won't. Last month I wrote about you're always writing 4 months ahead, so I don't remember what I wrote last, actually. But and I write for my local paper in Uniontown. I write an outdoor column for them every other week. I'm actually trying to motivate myself to do a piece of fiction, but that hasn't gotten very far. So
it comes in time with everything. I guess the last question I've got for you, Ben, is for the person who is trying to write something, and it doesn't matter what the genre really is, but they're not really sure how to proceed, what is the best piece of advice you give?
I like to think about that, people to write. And I think, have an interest, for one thing. Have a starting interest.
Yeah.
It could be baseball. It could be cooking. For me, it happened to be nature, which I came to through hunting and fishing. But pay attention enough to gain a body of authority, personal authority and authenticity, and then just put it down. I think that one of the big impediments is, especially in new writers, is this assumption that you have to get it right the first time.
Right.
And that's so difficult. There is no perfect way to write anything. There's no right way to write anything. There are just better ways to write something than the last version. So don't worry about getting it right the first time. I think it's very important to just get a draft down. And once you have that investment, you're much less likely to put that aside and give up on it than you are to never get started if you allow inertia to get in your way. So get something down and then work to polish it.
Up next, Paul Ricci, who talks about the history and changes of the region with a focus on Johnstown, when the Sunbury Press Book Show continues.
Sunbury Press Books brings the reader unique and independent works of fiction and nonfiction. Oxford Southern is our educational and academic imprint. Check out Shades of Brown by Todd Mealy, Philip Mosley's Telling of the Anthracite, or Wiley McCallan's A Man of Modern Letters, Ernest Hemingway, and the Rise of Modern Literature. Click on the Oxford Southern link for more at sunburypress.com.
Welcome back. Paul Ricci joins us on the show to discuss his self-published work, Wuthering Depths in Johnstown, by the numbers. A statistician, blogger, author, and educator, Ricci holds a degree in biostatistics and research methodology from the University of Pittsburgh. He is also the founder of Allegheny Independent Media. Here and in his book, Ricci discusses the history of his hometown, the changes, and the potential future of this region.
Well, I did grow up in Johnstown. I did move away for a while. I was in Pittsburgh for about 10 years, and then I was in Connecticut for a couple years, and Utah for a year. Finances kind of forced me to move back to Johnstown. Mm-hmm. So I was shocked by how the place had changed, and I felt like I needed to show people like some of the, you know, numbers. Certainly they're good at helping you see patterns that aren't easy to see with the naked eye. So that's why I decided to look at the trends in the population. You know, I mean, Johnstown at its height inside the city limits had 67,000 people. Mm-hmm. And now it's down to, well, less than, it's around 19,000 now.
I didn't realize it had dropped that much.
I mean, inside the city.
Right.
But yes, there are differences. I mean, the county population decreased by about 30,000 since 1960, mm-hmm, at its peak. And so, yes, it's been, yes, I mean, certainly, I mean, certainly I did witness the seismic shift in the politics of, you know, Cambria County, you know, which it does include Loretto and St. Francis.
Yep.
And I also looked at the, you know, like it was once a very reliable Democratic stronghold, but then between 2000 and 2012, it was about equal.
Right.
But then it shifted heavily towards Republicans with Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. So I tried to look at some of the reasons for that.
And that is in your book here.
Yes.
Tell us about some of the things, like what was the shift from your early time here? What do you remember about those early parts of being around Johnstown? And what is it, sort of lead us into what's changed here?
Well, okay. Well, I do remember, you know, growing up as a little kid, and, you know, I mean, obviously the first big event I remember is the 1977 flood.
Right.
You know, we, of course, had the big flood, the big one, 1889, and the 1936 floods. But,
right.
Well, 77 was what I remembered, and just a few years after that, that was when the steel mills closed. And, well, I mean, the big one, Bethlehem and U.S. Steel closed. And, yes, a lot of people were out of work.
Right.
You know, a lot of despair in the area. And, yes, a lot of people just simply moved out of the area.
Right. Now, are there, like, individual stories here, or are we going through different time frames within,
yes,
what we're talking about? Please,
yes,
explain some of that.
I do. You know, I go through, in the book, I go through, you know, its beginnings. I start with the founder of the city, Joseph Johns, originally it was Joseph Shantz. He was a Mennonite, mm-hmm, who came to the area and established a settlement. And, you know, with the Pennsylvania Canal, the city started to grow. And then the Cambria Iron Works was created in the 1850s. So, yes, it was very important for supplying our Union soldiers.
Right.
And then, yes, and then, of course, Andrew Carnegie came here, created the South Fork Hunting and Fishing Club. And, yes, you know, they reconstituted this old dam from the canal days. I mean, the Pennsylvania Canal pretty much ended around the 1850s.
Right.
And then the railroad came in, and then they created the South Fork Fishing and Hunting Club in the 1880s.
Yes.
You know, but of course they reconstituted this old dam, but never
used an engineer for that, if I remember correctly.
No. And yeah, and then of course the dam burst and 2,200 people were killed. Yeah. I mean, only 9/11 was a worse man-made disaster.
Right. And the with the steel, like if we jump back ahead a little bit, the steel mills closing and so forth, the economic opportunities, mm-hmm. it was like, was there a concerted effort to try to replace this or try to bring something in? Or what do you think has happened here?
Well, I mean, John Murtha, our congressman, mm-hmm. you know, he did bring a few defense contractors here and created the National Drug Intelligence. I mean, it's nowhere near replaced with what was lost. And, you know, but, you know, I mean, sometimes maybe the size of the area just kind of shrank. And, yes, some of the coal mining jobs were lost as well. So yes, it was. So, I mean, you know, it's hard to. So, really, it is kind of like we're coming back to the way it was almost during the canal days. It's returning to that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I do feel a lot of people in the area, they still kind of cling to the past, and we got to bring those steel mills back. And part of me says, well, maybe it's time we said good riddance.
Is it time, perhaps, that maybe the Johnstown-Altoona area embrace what Pittsburgh has done, the tech side of things, because of the tech hub and that sort of thing? Do you think it's possible?
Well, it will be harder. Obviously competing with lots of other Rust Belt areas for these things and to replace what was lost. I mean, you know, it's hard to find something that distinguishes it. I mean, of course, Pittsburgh, they're still at the confluence of three rivers and, mm-hmm. they were already larger size, so it was easier for them to recover.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, bringing the tech jobs, I mean, the best thing they have to advertise for it is it's cheap to relocate here.
Right.
That would be the best thing they have.
Sort of like a build back, at least in mm-hmm. something. You know, and it's interesting, too, because, I mean, I live in Harrisburg now.
Yeah.
And you see change. I mean, I grew up in northern Vermont, and I watched, my family's farm is one of the last of the farms in the county, and that used to be all that ever was.
Mm-hmm.
And you see change and you see this sort of disappearance of what we knew, and then you hope for someone to bring things around. It's like things are starting to change a little bit here and there, and yeah. You wonder, does Johnstown and these areas, does it need major investment? Does it need a major push?
Yeah.
What do you think is
certainly
necessary?
It would take a major infusion of capital to improve people's standards of living.
Right.
You know, I mean, yes, there is a high poverty rate around here. And even I noticed one thing that shocked me was African-American life expectancy in the area. Well, when I wrote the book, it was about 65 years was African-American life expectancy.
Right.
And, you know, which is almost like 10 years shorter than it is for whites.
Mm-hmm.
And like maybe about 5 years shorter than it is for African-Americans nationwide.
Right.
So I do think some efforts to improve the quality of life will have to address racial disparities mm-hmm. in the area as well.
So you were prompted by these observations to put this down and so forth. What is the response that people have given you on it?
Well, it's interesting. I know the Johnstown Area Heritage Association, they actually refused to sell my book.
Really?
They said, I don't know. Well, the reason they gave me was they said I talked about even things like crime statistics or like rape statistics, or I talked about the Catholic Church sex abuse. I mean, there was also a big grand jury investigation into
I had
into
to
that.
Read that report as part of my job, and that was not something I wanted to do.
Yes,
but it had to be done.
Yeah, and certainly they thought that would be inappropriate for kids, but, you know, it was It was never written for kids.
And it's a part of history, and it's a part of it is a part of what has occurred.
Yeah. I mean, but they said a book about the mafia in Johnstown was okay.
Go figure.
Yep.
Exactly.
But otherwise, outside, yes, I have been able to sell books. I'm close to about, I've sold about 170 of them.
Mm-hmm. Now, are you planning another volume? Are you planning to stretch out somewhere else?
I was thinking about writing about the COVID pandemic, like how it impacted the area. I mean, Donald Trump did come here. He had lots of rallies without masks. Mm-hmm. You know, right before the vaccine came out, and yes, that led to a lot of deaths. I mean, it was certainly the winter of 2020 was a bad Christmas.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
So,
well, where can people find your book and find you?
Well, I do have my website here, Allegheny Independent Media. Okay, I mean, I was lucky after I published the book, I was approached by someone from the Leveler Foundation. He offered me a grant opportunity to create this website and, you know, sort of like a Democracy Now for the area. And, you know, yes, we are working on promoting the website and looking for contributors. So this is, I figure, even coming here was a good opportunity to do so.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is the thing about the conference, is that we're seeing a lot of different writers, meeting a lot of different people, and it can only be good.
Yep. Certainly more points of view are better than fewer.
My thanks to PJ, Ben, and Paul for their time, and our congratulations to Ben Moyer, as Smoke to See By was named the Wakona Book of the Year for 2024. Also, our congratulations to Julia Kasdorf, who earned the Outstanding Contribution Award for As Is, published by the University of Pittsburgh Press. This first look in on the Wakona Conference highlights the groundswell of authors, poets, and artists who are making a name for themselves, but also in the name of this region. The BookSpeak Network hopes to bring more of these to you in future. Part 2 of the Wakona Conference will come in a future program. Thank you for listening to the Sunbury Press Book Show on the BookSpeak Network. Check out our website at www.sunburypress.com for our latest releases. Be sure to subscribe to our newsletter to receive special offers and discounts.